This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Imagine a cargo plane dropping you off in a remote corner of the African jungle. The area you've just entered is under quarantine for a mysterious plague. Nobody knows how many people it has killed, but all who have fallen sick die within 8 days. First high fever, headache, hallucinations, then usually bleeding to death. Oh, and no one knows what's causing this sickness or how it spreads, and you've been dropped into this, and it's your job to find out. This Hollywood scenario is a true story, as told in my next guest's new book. The author and the protagonist of that sci-fi scenario is the virus hunter Peter Piot, who was sent to the Democratic Republic of Congo in 1976 to solve this real-life deadly mystery. And he ended up discovering the Ebola virus. And he went on to investigate early outbreaks of HIV in Africa and spent 14 years leading UNAIDS. Peter Piot is the author of No Time to Lose, A Life in Pursuit of Deadly Viruses. He's also director of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He joins us from the BBC. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Piot. Welcome.
Hello.
Hey there. Hey. You open the book with this scene of a flask arriving in your lab from Zaire, and inside it is blood infected with an unknown pathogen. Better you than me, I would say. This sounds pretty scary. What, I mean, there's just all this blood arrives and you're there, you don't know what's in it or what's happening.
That's right. I mean, we were a lab in Antwerp that was certified to investigate yellow fever, and you can vaccinate yourself against yellow fever, very effective vaccine. And so we got these blood samples from a Flemish nun who had died in what was then called Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, with some mysterious disease, but they thought it was yellow fever. So we did all the routine for yellow fever, and it was indeed a blue shiny flask at the thermos, and the vial with the blood, one of the vials, was broken. So there was ice full of blood in addition to that.
And what's your feeling when you see this? This is exciting, or I'm in trouble?
No, this is exciting in the first place because, one, we didn't know that it would be what would come out of it. You know, it's unknown. But we took some precautions, of course, you know, wearing gloves and so on. But if we would have known that this were Ebola or something of that category, of course, we would not have handled it because we were not equipped for it. But you do your job. And then we found the virus that was unlike any other except one type, and that was a virus called Marburg, after the town in Germany where workers who are making vaccines got contaminated from monkey kidneys. And so you do your job, and then at some point you say, my God, this is new. And that's really a combination of the excitement of discovery, but also pretty scary, and you want to know more about it. And that's how it started. So it's in the one hand, it's anything can happen. It's an coincidence. But on the other hand, you've got to be prepared to deal with that kind of situations.
What kind of preparation can you do? Is it a mental state that I'm going to work on this, even though it's a scary thing, but it needs to be done?
Yeah, two things. One, mental state, yes, but also that you really have all the skills to do it. You're well trained. That you know how to protect yourself. Mm-hmm. And this was at the time, let's not forget it, and something that my students have a hard time understanding. This, there was no internet, even cell phones didn't exist. So communication was very, very limited. And so all we got was a small piece of paper and with diagnosis, yellow fever, ? But you know, it's fairly straightforward how to protect yourself from viruses. I mean, we know in general how they're transmitted, and right. In the lab you protect your hands, your mouth, your right. Your eyes, and so on. So that's possible.
So now you've gotten this broken vial in your in your laboratory. You've figured out what it is, and now you have to go find it. And you get dropped into Africa to search for it.
Well, first of all, I should say give credit to the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, who could positively say that this was a new virus, because we thought it may be like this Marburg virus, but they could prove beyond doubt that it was something new, which was then afterwards called Ebola after a river in Zaire. Yeah, and then, you know, then of course you want to know, how is this transmitted, who is getting it, how many people are being infected and dying. And so indeed, that's how I went with a group of people from particularly from Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, and some colleagues from Zaire, to the epidemic zone, which is really in the middle of nowhere, in the heart of the forest. You know, Joseph Conrad's book, for those who have read it, The Heart of Darkness. And that's where there was this Catholic mission. And the first thing you want to know is, you know, are there still people dying? Are there still people infected? Or is this a rumor? Because there were so many rumors flying around, pilots who dropped us there and they never stopped the engine. They said, get out of here. And then they left because the rumors said that hundreds of people had died. There were cadavers in the streets. Even the birds flying over this area, which is called Yambugu, they came down with this virus. And so you want to know what's going on. And frankly, the three things you try to find out is who is affected, how many people, where are they, and you know, when did it start, and you plot all that in terms of curves. So what we call, try to define it in terms of time, place, and person. And that gives you already a bit of information. The scary thing, though, was that it sounds like nobody survived until we found two nurses who had survived. And secondly, that we had no clue how this virus was transmitted. Was it you know, airborne, through food, water, sex, coughing, you know, shaking hands, mosquitoes, you know, the classic ways. And that took a while before we found out.
And so you must have thought at one point you're going to come down with this if you had no idea how it was transmitted, and there are corpses all around you.
Yeah, at some point, yeah. Well, first of all, I was only 27, so I was so excited. It was also my first time in Africa, or in Central Africa. And it's the excitement of discovery is a bit like a drug, you know, and everything was new, and you also want to solve the problem, because people were still dying. So there is an enormous urgency. It's really... And I told myself, you know, we can't lose any time, no time to lose, because we need to stop this epidemic. And so that takes the, you know, precedence over your own angst, basically. But then at some point I developed a bit of fever and a bit of diarrhea, and I said, oh my God, I got it. But fortunately, after 24 hours, it was over. Yeah.
Talking with Peter Piat, who is author of No Time to Lose, A Life in Pursuit of Deadly Viruses. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, and also leave messages on our Facebook. Do you think if you had been a lot older and wiser then, you would not have undertaken this scary sort of mission?
I think I would have still have done it, and I would love to do it again. But I, you know, I'm 63 now, but I think I would be... make sure that I had better communication and a better safety net and so on. But I would still go for it, yes.
Have you been called the Indiana Jones of viruses?
No. And that's I'm not in a high-risk type of person, but it's also the fact that when you see a disaster like that, you know, it's our job to stop it. That's why, you know, I went into medicine and epidemiology. And... if everybody's just look at it and doesn't take up the responsibility, you know, then more people will die. Mm-hmm. But it's also, to be honest, it's a mixture of scientific curiosity and also the call to save lives.
You write that one of your professors actually told you at the beginning of your career, quote, there's no future in infectious diseases. They've all been solved.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that was a prevailing opinion in the 70s, you know, we have antibiotics, we have vaccines, and so it's done. Why waste your time in a career in infectious diseases? But I'm pretty stubborn. Plus, I really developed a big interest in microbes and in people. And in my short life, you know, we've seen Ebola virus, many new viruses that emerged, mad cow disease, and then, of course, there was AIDS a few years later. And our team, again, together with colleagues from Centers for Disease Control and now also from the National Institutes of Health, and then our Congolese colleagues, we could demonstrate that there was this unknown but big heterosexual epidemic of AIDS in Africa. And that was in 83, at a time when, you know, AIDS didn't even exist as a name, and it was called the gay-related immune deficiency syndrome.
GRIDS,
the dogma was,
yeah.
GRIDS, yeah, exactly. And I could never understand why a virus would care about the sexual orientation of its human host. It's not very romantic, but from the perspective of a virus, you know, sex between humans is just an opportunity to jump from one cell to the other, from one host to another, and so to perpetuate your own life. And so we found this big heterosexual epidemic. It was in the very same hospitals that I had visited in 76 in Kinshasa. And then I understood that we were in deep trouble, because we had no clue in the early 80s whether AIDS would become a very big epidemic worldwide, or would be confined to, you know, either to the gay population, or would die out spontaneously. We had no clue. We didn't even know what the cause was then. The virus hadn't been isolated. So that was excitement. But here I immediately saw that this was very much unlike Ebola. As you said, in Ebola, you're dead after, you know, 2 weeks basically after infection. 1 week after infection, you get ill, and then a week later, you're dead. Here in the case of AIDS, it was young people, in these days my age, and you know, it seems that this really protracted disease, we didn't know yet that you could be asymptomatic, be a carrier of the virus for like 10 years and be perfectly healthy, and in other words, transmit it. And what was so special also then is that we found that the majority of people with HIV, with AIDS then, came down with AIDS, were actually women. And that was also very, very new. In the West, we, you know, it was gay men or people had received blood transfusion or had hemophilia.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you talk about blood samples, old blood samples of Ebola, and you went to look back into them and you found AIDS in those blood samples, your HIV virus in the sample?
That's right. In 86, when we had enough kits to test antibodies for HIV so that you can see whether someone was infected or not. Mm-hmm. What we did is we went back to the samples that we had collected in 76 during the Ebola outbreak, so 10 years before, and when nobody had ever heard of AIDS, because the first cases of AIDS were reported from the US in June 1981. And so we found antibodies. It was less than 1% of the population in that zone where we had found Ebola virus were already HIV positive. So that was the first indication that HIV had been around for longer than 81. Also that it had been in Africa for probably quite a while. And today we know it's about, probably it started maybe 100 years old or a bit more recent, and that HIV jumped from chimpanzees to probably hunters or so in Africa, and then the virus slowly spread for many years, because what we found is that in 10 years later, in 86, the same percentage of people were HIV positive. So in other words, the virus had not spread that fast in that very remote region, but the people who were positive in 76 had died.
Mm-hmm. Let me just interrupt to say, remind everybody that this is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flato with Peter Piot, author of No Time to Lose, A Life in Pursuit of Deadly Viruses. Fascinating story about AIDS. So you're saying that AIDS has been around much longer than we thought it was.
Yes, absolutely. And It took a while to figure that out. One, because we had no test. You know, the antibody test only came on the market in 85, and then the priority was to make sure that no blood would be transfused that is HIV positive. That was a priority. And then when it became more widely available, we could test old samples like the ones that we had collected in 76 in Zaire during the Ebola outbreak. So, and then there were an odd sample of the 59 from Leopoldville, which was then the name of the capital of Congo. And then through analysis of the genome of the, you know, the genetic makeup of the virus, we could see that in Africa, particularly Central Africa, that these viruses were far more diverse genetically than what we find in the U.S., for example. Mm-hmm. And then through a combination of genetics and mathematics, one can find out when the, let's say, the mother virus must have emerged, and that's probably the beginning of the 20th century. And in the meantime, also my team found that in from chimpanzees in Gabon, and then from the zoo in Antwerp, the town where I was working, that some chimpanzees carry a virus that is very, very similar to the one that we find in people. And so, and then putting all that together told us the story, basically, that for probably a long time, HIV or an HIV ancestor of HIV was infecting chimpanzees with not necessarily a lot of problems, and then at some point it jumped over to to some hunter probably.
Wow. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Peter Piat, who is author of No Time to Lose: A Life in Pursuit of Deadly Viruses. He's director of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. You can also tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI, and also send us a message on our website at sciencefriday.com. Join the conversation there. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
Oh, le sida, une terrible maladie. Le sida, un mal qui ne pardonne pas. Le sida, un mal qui n'épargne personne. Oh, ce fléau, le sida, qui laisse impuissante la médecine.
That was Congolese musician Franca Luambo with his 1987 track, Attention la Nacida. Sida means AIDS in French. My guest is Peter Piat, author of No Time to Lose, A Life in Pursuit of Deadly Viruses. Peter, you talk about that song in your book and how music was key to raising awareness about AIDS and HIV.
Yeah, well, first of all, I love Congolese music, and Franco has been one of the greatest musicians. And by the way, he died from AIDS himself. But, you know, when you what do you do with AIDS? What do you do against it? Particularly before there was any treatment, it was education, making people aware. And you can go with a billboard saying AIDS kills, you know, that doesn't work very well. So you need to really use the media that people like. Mm-hmm. Is it music? It's in the churches. It's theater. Radio can be very important. And that's what Franco did. And and in his song, he said, you know, be faithful, use a condom. And it was very straightforward. But people were dancing it at the same time.
You write in your book about meeting Thabo Mbeki, Nelson Mandela's successor as president of South Africa, and how he did not believe, I remember he used to say, I don't believe there is a connection between HIV and AIDS. What was it like working with these world leaders who were AIDS deniers at those times?
Yeah, after, I'm a scientist by background and still am one. And so in the beginning, I thought, okay, we've got the facts, we've got the epidemiology and, this disaster. So that's enough. And when people see that, politicians, the ones who hold the purse, and they will act. But that was very naive. And we only made serious progress when the powerful of this world were taking on AIDS. And, and that changed around the millennium. 2001 was really a tipping point when at the United Nations, over 40 heads of state, heads of government came together and said, we've got to do something about AIDS, and particularly African president, who, broke the silence. And then in 2003, PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, was created by President Bush, and here we went. But there were also others, and particularly in the 80s, many denied that there was AIDS in their country. And one of the worst was Thabo Mbeki, because here we've got South Africa, one of the worst affected countries in the world in terms of AIDS. Out of a population of 45 million, there were then 4 to 5 million people infected. And he said, no, this is not AIDS, this is poverty. He didn't believe that HIV was causing it. And he was really slowing down access to life-saving treatment, which had come on the market in 96, and which was literally saving the lives of people with HIV in Western countries. The price was too high in these days, that's true. But when the price came down of these drugs, even then Thabo Mbeki didn't believe it. So that was very tough. And another example is in Russia. Russia, which has the still growing AIDS epidemic, it's driven by injecting drug use, and the government is still not ready to go for so-called harm reduction in drug users, in other words, providing them with clean needles and so on, and methadone, so that they don't inject drugs and spread HIV. That was a tough part of my job. But it was also, as so many things, it's thanks to the unique combination of the right politics and the science, scientific discovery, and programs on the ground. When you have that, when these stars are aligned, you can move mountains. And I think that's what we're seeing now, huge achievements and millions of lives saved.
You also spent an evening chatting with Fidel Castro at his presidential palace, and if I read it correctly, might have changed his mind a little bit.
Yeah, originally Cuba would, lock up people with HIV. Cuba had lots of troops in Africa in these days, and some returned with HIV, and they were all tested. And when they were HIV positive, they were basically put in a so-called sanatorium, which was a kind of a prison, and a camp with, although they were getting good food and so on. And but in the meantime, HIV was present in the community in Cuba. And I told Fidel, you don't talk about human rights with Fidel Castro. You know, it's too expensive, it doesn't work. And also, what happened afterwards is that the sanatoria were opened and people with HIV were trained to become educators, talking about prevention, going to schools, and so on. So turning it around in a positive way.
Mm-hmm. Moving back to Ebola, this week a study came out in which researchers cured monkeys of Ebola.
Yes.
You know about that, using a cocktail of antibodies. Do you think that a human vaccine might be on the horizon?
Well, this is investigators in Winnipeg in Canada who found that by giving very specific, a combination, a cocktail, of very specific antibodies could cure monkeys. Now, there's still a long way to go whether this can be used in people. Also, I think because in most people, the disease develops in a very fulminant way. And so you have basically a collapse of your blood coagulation system. So that's why you start bleeding all over. But it's a breakthrough, and it's a very important development. So as so often, there will be then a lot of incremental steps that have to be taken before it can be be applied in people.
Did you see the movie Contagion?
Yes, I did. Yes.
What did you think about its accuracy and the message it had there?
Well, I think it's great that, first of all, that such a movie was made, and it was scientifically certainly very accurate. They had very good also scientific consultants from Columbia University and CDC, and these things could happen. But of course, it's to make it a movie. It shows the more spectacular side of the work, because when you investigate an epidemic, an outbreak like Ebola or AIDS, a lot of the time is not very very sexy, and that. But no, I think it's great.
Yeah. It shows what a lot of hard work, and actually scientists are heroes in that film, whereas it's supposed to be villains. Are there other viruses that we don't know of, terrible viruses lurking out there?
Well, definitely. I mean, basically, all the time, new viruses are being discovered, particularly in animals. We've got also the flu, you know. It's absolutely certain that one day we'll have a big flu epidemic in the world. And we also have old viruses, which are still there. Poliovirus, which was such a terrible plague in the U.S. in the 50s, and then was, thanks to the vaccine, was wiped out, is still there in countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan or parts of Nigeria. So there are the old problems. They haven't gone away yet, although we should do everything we can to eliminate polio. But then, you know, there will be new viruses will emerge all the time. It's viruses coming from animals and in contact with human beings. And in the case of Ebola, these are fairly self-contained, relatively small epidemics, killing a few hundred people, particularly if people are hospitalized and not, you know, in not very hygienic circumstances. And then, you know, there will be also through our food chain, I think, food supply, which is being globalized and with massive production of food, that we could also see some big outbreaks, as we've seen in Europe recently. And, you know, in the old days when you're a chicken got a salmonella infection in your backyard, that would infect a few other chickens who would die, and maybe the family came down and so on, but that's it. But today you've got chicken farms with a million chickens. And who are shipped all over the country or all over the world. And so making sure that our food supply is absolutely safe is one of the big challenges of this globalizing, food production. And we saw it also with mad cow disease in Europe, where cattle was fed with other cattle and then in that sense, became infected and infected a few people.
In our last moments here, what's on the horizon for you? What are you going to be up to now?
Well, I'm returned to academia. I'm now the director of the London School of Hygiene Tropical Medicine, which is a fantastic place. It's the premier, school in the world for public health, and to train the new generation of leaders, so that they will be prepared for new epidemics of infectious diseases. But also, the largest epidemic at the moment is a true tsunami of chronic diseases, diabetes, obesity. I mean, the U.S. is affected by it, but also we're seeing now it's taken over Asia, Latin America, the Caribbean, the Middle East, and we've got to work on that as well. So it's not only new viruses, but it's also through lifestyle, through unhealthy food, lack of of movement and smoking, that's killing now more people than anything else in the world.
Well, good luck to you, Peter, and thank you for taking time to be with us today. And it's a fantastic book. Congratulations to you.
Thank you, Ara.
Peter Piot is the author of No Time to Lose: A Life in Pursuit of Deadly Viruses, and he's also director of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and former executive director of UNAIDS. And as I say, it's a great book. It's well within your time to have a read. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them.